That's no longer up to me. Halleck grimaced. Distrans. What was the range of those damned cave bats? He'd often seen them flitting across the desert with hidden messages imprinted upon their squeaking calls. But how far would they go on this hellhole planet? I must see him for myself, Halleck said.
That's not permitted.
Halleck took a deep breath to quiet himself. He had spent 2 days and 2 nights waiting for search reports. Now it was another morning, and he felt his role dissolving around him, leaving him naked. He had never liked command anyway. Command always waited while others did the interesting and dangerous things. "Why isn't it permitted?" he asked. The smugglers who'd arranged this safe siege had left too many questions unanswered, and he wanted no more of the same from Namri.
"Some believe you saw too much when you saw this siege," Namri said.
Halleck heard the menace, relaxed into the easy stance of the trained fighter, hand near but not on his knife. He longed for a shield, but that had been ruled out by its effect on the worms, its short life in the presence of storm-generated static charges.
"This secrecy isn't part of our agreement," Halleck said.
"If I'd killed him, would that have been part of our agreement?"
Again, Halleck felt the jockeying of unseen forces about which the Lady Jessica hadn't warned him. This damned plan of hers. Maybe it was right not to trust the Bene Gesserit. Immediately, he felt disloyal. She'd explained the problem, and he'd come into her plan with the expectation that it, like all plans, would need adjustments later. That wasn't any Bene Gesserit. This was Jessica of the Atreides, who'd never been other than friend and supporter to him. Without her, he knew he'd have been adrift in a universe more dangerous than the one he now inhabited.
"You can't answer to my question," Namri said.
"You were to kill him only if he showed himself to be possessed," Halleck said. "Abomination."
Namri put his fist beside his right ear.
"Your lady knew we had tests for such. Wise of her to leave that judgment in my hands."
Halleck compressed his lips in frustration.
"You heard the Reverend Mother's words to me," Namri said. "We Fremen understand such women, but you off-worlders never understand them. Fremen women often send their sons to death."
Halleck spoke past still lips.
"Are you telling me you've killed him?"
"He lives. He is in a safe place. He'll continue to receive the spice."
"But I'm to escort him back to his grandmother if he survives," Halleck said.
Namri merely shrugged. Halleck understood that this was all the answer he'd get.
Damn.
He couldn't go back to Jessica with such unanswered questions. He shook his head.
"Why question what you cannot change?" Namri asked. "You are being well paid."
Halleck scowled at the man. Fremen. They believed all foreigners were influenced primarily by money. But Namri was speaking more than Fremen prejudice. Other forces were at work here, and that was obvious to one who'd been trained in observation by a Bene Gesserit. This whole thing had the smell of a feint within a feint within a feint. Shifting to the insultingly familiar form, Halleck said,
"The Lady Jessica will be wrathful. She could send cohorts against Zanadik," Namri cursed. "You office messenger, you stand outside the Mohalata. I take pleasure in possessing your water for the noble people."
Halleck rested a hand on his knife, readied his left sleeve where he'd prepared a small surprise for attackers.
"I see no water spilled here," he said. "Perhaps you're blinded by your pride."
"You live because I wished you to learn before dying that your Lady Jessica will not send cohorts against anyone. You are not to be lured quietly into the Huanui, off-world scum. I am of the noble people, and you,
and I'm just a servant of the Atreides," Halleck said, voice mild. "We are the scum who lifted the Harkonnen yoke from your smelly neck."
Namri showed white teeth in a grimace.
"Your lady is a prisoner on Seleucus Secundus. The notes you thought were from her came from her daughter."
By extreme effort, Halleck managed to keep his voice even.
"No matter. Alia will..."
Namri drew his criss knife.
"What do you know of the womb of heaven? I am her servant, you male whore. I do her bidding when I take your water."
And he lunged across the room with foolhardy directness. Halleck, not allowing himself to be tricked by such seeming clumsiness, flicked up the left arm of his robe, releasing the extra length of heavy fabric he'd had sewn there, letting that take Namri's knife. In the same movement, Halleck swept the folds of cloth over Namri's head, came in under and threw the cloth with his own knife aimed directly for the face. He felt the point bite home as Namri's body hit him with a hard surface of metal armor beneath the robe. The Fremen emitted one outraged squeal, jerked backward, and fell. He lay there, blood gushing from his mouth, as his eyes glared at Halleck, then slowly dulled. Halleck blew air through his lips. How could that fool Namri have expected anyone to miss the presence of armor beneath the robe? Halleck addressed the corpse as he recovered the trick sleeve, wiped his knife, and sheathed it.
"How do you think we Atreides' servants were trained, fool?"
He took a deep breath, thinking, "Well, now, whose faint am I?" There had been the ring of truth in Namri's words. Jessica, a prisoner of the Carinos, and Alia working her own devious schemes. Jessica herself had warned of many contingencies with Alia as enemy, but had not predicted herself as prisoner. He had his orders to obey, though. First, there was the necessity of getting away from this place. Luckily, one robed Fremen looked much like another. He rolled Namri's body into a corner, threw cushions over it, moved a rug to cover the blood. When it was done, Halleck adjusted the nose and mouth tubes of his stillsuit, brought up the mask as one would in preparing for the desert, pulled the hood of his robe forward, and went out into the long passage. "The innocent move without care," he thought, setting his pace at an easy saunter. He felt curiously free, as though he'd moved out of danger, not into it. "I never did like her plan for the boy," he thought, "and I'll tell her so if I see her. If..." Because if Namri spoke the truth, the most dangerous alternate plan went into effect. Alia wouldn't let him live long if she caught him, but there was always Stilgar, a good Fremen with a good Fremen's superstitions. Jessica had explained it. "There's a very thin layer of civilized behavior over Stilgar's original nature, and here's how you take that layer off him."
The spirit of Muad'Dib is more than words, more than the letter of the law which arises in his name. Muad'Dib must always be that inner outrage against the complacently powerful, against the charlatans and the dogmatic fanatics. It is that inner outrage which must have its say, because Muad'Dib taught us one thing above all others, that humans can endure only in a fraternity of social justice.
The Fadakan Compact. Leto sat with his back against the wall of the hut, his attention on Sabiha, watching the threads of his vision unroll. She had prepared the coffee and set it aside. Now she squatted across from him, stirring his evening meal. It was a gruel, redolent with mélange. Her hands moved quickly with the ladle, and liquid indigo stained the sides of his bowl. She bent her thin face over the bowl, blending in the concentrate. The crude membrane which made a still tent of the hut had been patched with lighter material directly behind her, and this formed a gray halo against which her shadow danced in the flickering light of the cooking flame and the single lamp. That lamp intrigued Leto. These people of Shulak were profligate with spice oil. A lamp, not a glow globe. They kept slave outcasts within their walls in the fashion told by the most ancient Fremen traditions. Yet they employed ornithopters and the latest spice harvesters. They were a crude mixture of ancient and modern. Sabiha pushed the bowl of gruel toward him, extinguished the cooking flame. Leto ignored the bowl.
"I will be punished if you do not eat this," she said.
He stared at her, thinking, "If I kill her, that'll shatter one vision. If I tell her Marisa's plans, that'll shatter another vision. If I wait here for my father, this vision thread will become a mighty rope." His mind sorted the threads. Some held a sweetness which haunted him. One future with Sabiha carried alluring reality within his prescient awareness. It threatened to block out all others until he followed it out to its ending agonies.
"Why do you stare at me that way?" she asked.
Still, he did not answer. She pushed the bowl closer to him. Leto tried to swallow in a dry throat. The impulse to kill Sabiha welled in him. He found himself trembling with it. How easy it would be to shatter one vision and let the wildness run free.
"Maurice commands this," she said, touching the bowl.
Yes, Maurice commanded it. Superstition conquered everything. Maurice wanted a vision cast for him to read. He was an ancient savage asking the witch doctor to throw the ox bones and interpret their sprawl. Maurice had taken his captive's stillsuit as a simple precaution. There had been a sly jibe at Namri and Sabiha in that comment. Only fools let a prisoner escape. Maurice had a deep emotional problem, though, the spirit river. The captive's water flowed in Maurice's veins. Maurice sought a sign that would permit him to hold a threat of death over Leto.
Like father, like son, Leto thought. The spice will only give you visions, Sabiha said.
The long silences made her uneasy.
I've had visions in the orgy many times. They don't mean anything.
That's it, he thought, his body locking itself into a stillness which left his skin cold and clammy. The Bene Gesserit training took over his consciousness, a pinpoint illumination which fanned out beyond him to throw the blazoning light of vision upon Sabiha and all of her cast-out fellows. The ancient Bene Gesserit learning was explicit.
Languages build up to reflect specializations in a way of life. Each specialization may be recognized by its words, by its assumptions and sentence structures. Look for stoppages. Specializations represent places where life is being stopped, where the movement is dammed up and frozen.
He saw Sabiha then as a vision-maker in her own right, and every other human carried the same power. Yet she was disdainful of her spice orgy visions. They caused disquiet, and therefore must be put aside, forgotten deliberately. Her people prayed to Shai-Hulud because the worm dominated many of their visions. They prayed for dew at the desert's edge because moisture limited their lives. Yet they wallowed in spice wealth and lured sand trout to open carnots. Sabiha fed him prescient visions with a casual callousness. Yet within her words he saw the illuminated signals. She depended upon absolutes, sought finite limits, and all because she couldn't handle the rigors of terrible decisions which touched her own flesh. She clung to her one-eyed vision of the universe, englobing and time-freezing as it might be, because the alternatives terrified her. In contrast, Leto felt the pure movement of himself. He was a membrane collecting infinite dimensions, and because he saw those dimensions, he could make the terrible decisions. As my father did.
You must eat this, Sabiha said, her voice petulant.
Leto saw the whole pattern of the visions now, and knew the thread he must follow.
My skin is not my own.
He stood, pulling his robe around him. It felt strange against his flesh, with no stillsuit protecting his body. His feet were bare upon the fused spice fabric of the floor, feeling the sand tracked in there.
What are you doing?
Sabiha demanded. The air is bad in here. I'm going outside.
You can't escape, she said. Every canyon has its worm. If you go beyond the Karnat, the worms will sense you by your moisture. These captive worms are very alert, not like the ones in the desert at all. Besides,
how gloating her voice became,
you've no stillsuit.
Then why do you worry? He asked, wondering if he might yet provoke a real reaction from her.
Because you've not eaten.
And you'll be punished.
Yes.
But I'm already saturated with spice, he said. Every moment is a vision. He gestured with a bare foot at the bowl. Pour that onto the sand. Who'll know?
They watch, she whispered.
He shook his head, shedding her from his visions, feeling new freedom envelop him. No need to kill this poor pawn. She danced to other music, not even knowing the steps, believing that she might yet share the power which lured the hungry pirates of Shulak and Jacarutu. Leto went to the door seal, put a hand upon it.
When Maurice comes, she said, he'll be very angry with—
Maurice is a merchant of emptiness, Leto said.
My aunt has drained him.
She got to her feet.
I'm going out with you.
And he thought, she remembers how I escaped her. Now she feels the fragility of her hold upon me. Her visions stir within her. But she would not listen to those visions. She had but to reflect. How could he outwit a captive worm in its narrow canyon? How could he live in the Tanzaruft without stillsuit or fremkit?
I must be alone to consult my visions, he said.
You'll remain here.
Where will you go?
To the Karnat.
The Sandrot come out in swarms at night.
They won't eat me.
Sometimes the worm comes down to just beyond the water, she said. If you cross the Karnat—
She broke off, trying to edge her words with menace. How could I mount a worm without hooks? He asked, wondering if she still could salvage some bit of her visions.
Will you eat when you return?
She asked, squatting once more by the bowl, recovering the ladle and stirring the indigo broth.